This shiur comes in the wake of a number of events in the last few weeks. And part of it is that, as we know, that despite the assertions of our Secretary of State that the past attacks have been triggered by a mass increase of settlements or various other very well-researched philosophies, it is very clear that a lot of the attacks recently have been triggered by, firstly, a speech that Abbas gave in the UN, talking about the filthy feet of the Jews on the Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa compounds, and a number of Arab MKs who were talking about how the Temple Mount was threatened. No change of policy was actually slated, no change of policy was instituted, but nonetheless, the threat of it was sufficient grounds to create the rumor, as Yossi Klein Halevi just said yesterday in our show, to spark once again, because this is not a new thing, the attacks which were triggered. More than that, at the same time, not only were we attacked on the radical front from within the mosques, we were also attacked from the academic community. And the academic community means to say the face of the academic community, because not the academic community themselves, but the presentation of it. In an article which was really shocking that a news agency of such status could even release such such inaccuracies. An article was revised, the title of the article in the New York Times on October 8th, and remember this is really in the thick of things, was "Historical Certainty Proves Elusive at Jerusalem's Holiest Site." And this is none other than the Times foreign editor, high profile, and in the correction, this is what it says in the editor's note, which very few people have taken the time to read. An article on Thursday with the headlines "Historical Certainty Proves Elusive at Jerusalem's Holiest Place" examined the scholarly debate about two ancient Jewish temples and the Temple Mount, a site sacred to the Jews, Muslims, and Christians. While the article laid out the history of the Jewish temples and the archaeological and historical evidence about them, the headline and a passage in the initial version of the article implied incorrectly that questions among scholars about the location of the temples potentially affected Jewish claims to the site and Israel's broader assertion of sovereignty over Jerusalem. In fact, as the article was later corrected to clarify, the scholarly debate is a narrower one, focused on the precise location of Temple Mount, where the long-destroyed temples once stood. All versions of the article should have made clear that the archaeological and historical uncertainties about the site, unlike assertions by some Palestinians that the temples never existed, do not directly challenge the Jewish claims to the Temple Mount. But to release such an article to the public, after having interviewed a number of the scholars, in fact, there's somebody in our shul who was telling me that they were in touch with one of the professors from North Carolina, one of the ladies who was interviewed, and she had an hour-long interview, and it was pretty clear what she was saying. It wasn't that there was a misunderstanding in the interview. She wrote a letter to the editor, which, of course, is not necessarily going to be read by the greater public. It was a small little footnote somewhere, tucked away. But in the end of the day, the damage was done. The damage wasn't just historical. The damage, of course, is in human life. Moreover, just this last week, we've had the tail end of all this violence, the response of UNESCO. Here's the UN really catching history at the right point, as always. UNESCO, and this is an article in the New York Times, also corrected again. Arab proposal of the UN to UN over Western Wall stirs new concerns. United Nations, senior United Nations officials have objected to a proposal by some Arab states to classify the Western Wall, one of the holiest sites in Judaism, as part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem's Old City, following angry denunciations by Israel and many Jewish American groups. And the correction, of course, was that they classified the Western Wall as the holiest site of Judaism. Meaning to say, that's what we've always been longing for, is just the Western Wall. And they had to correct that, of course. And then there was a proposal by one of the French representatives in the UN to have an international committee now in charge of Temple Mount. And all these claims keep coming up again and again. And it's funny how they spark off specifically at the time when nothing's changed, nothing's new. All that's new is rumors and blood libels. Moreover, I started doing a little bit of research on this, and one of the books I was reading was a book called Jerusalem's Temple Mount, From Solomon to the Golden Dome. There's a number of books on this. I was going through the YU library, which has an incredible amount of wealth of information on this. And in an introduction to this book, which is primarily an archaeological study, the author explains, it's Herschel Shanks, says he explains the reason why he's writing the book. And here he is, and just to see the atrocity in these words. He says, the Palestinian claim in source 3, the Palestinian claim denying the existence of the Israelite temple is both vague and ambiguous. The claim is made quite generally that the Jewish temple never existed on the Haram. Sometimes it seems to refer only to Solomon's temple, sometimes to an Israelite temple, sometimes only to the location of an Israelite Jewish temple. For example, at Camp David. Camp David, folks, this is recent history, okay? Yasser Arafat told an American negotiator, Dennis Ross, and others that even if Herod's temple did exist, it was not in Jerusalem, but in Nablus, a city 30 miles north of Jerusalem. Arafat was referring to the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim in Nablus. The Samaritans are a Jewish offshoot, and Mount Gerizim is their holy mountain, just as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is for the Jews. I mean, we're talking about archaeologically verifiable subjects, and we're talking about the year 2000. I mean, you have to think about this. Kamil Khatib, a vice chairman of the Islamic movement, which works closely with the Muslim religious trust known as the Waqf, admits that a Jewish temple may have existed, but not in Jerusalem. This is what they're talking about, folks. Arafat admitted to President Clinton's at Camp David that his faith forbade him from recognizing the existence of the Jewish temple. I'm a religious man, Arafat said, and I will not allow it to be written of me in history that I have confirmed the existence of the so-called temple underneath the mountain. Moreover, on the other hand, even Arafat admitted the existence of Herod's temple. The Jews have no claim to the whole area of the Haram al-Shif. They, the Israelites, excavated everything, and they didn't find a single stone from the Temple of Solomon, just some stones from the Temple of Herod. So he sort of, you know, at different times, you know, says different things. He, meaning to say the second temple he allowed. The PA minister, Nabil Shaath, chief negotiator of the 93 Oslo Agreement, has referred to the Jewish temple as fictitious. You have to just put that in context. Here you have the man who's negotiating the Oslo Accord. And his basis of negotiating is that there's no temple. Just to put it in perspective. Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, the president of the Palestinian National Authority, who just gave that speech in the UN, has stated Israel should not claim that the Jewish temple is underneath the Haram. I challenge that assertion. And he goes on, and so this is the reason why Herschel Shanks goes on to write his book, and his book is primarily focused on archaeology. And he goes backwards in history, and he tears backwards into each tier of history. For me, just reading this, and there's so much of this, it just reminds me of the first Rashi on the Torah. And listen to this Rashi, let's dig into this Rashi. Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak. He says the following, Rashi in Bereishis 1:1. Start at the very beginning, folks. Bereishis, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, lo hayat tzarich lahaskil ha-satara ela mehachadosh ha-zalachem. We should have already started the Torah where the mitzvahs begin, the national mitzvahs begin, which is in Parashas Boy. She mitzvah rishona, she nistavu by Yisrael, which is the first mitzvah which Israel was commanded. Uma atam, posach b'bereishis, mishum, koyach ma'asov higid la'amoy. The pasuk in Tehillim, that Hashem shows his strength to his nation, la'aseis lahem nachas, going to give them the nation, the inheritance of the nations. She'im yomru ha'am umos ha'olam, if the nations of the world might say, as they do say, Li Yisrael, listim atem, you are bandits, you've taken out what is rightfully ours, shekavashtim arzos shivas goyim, you took the nations of the Canaanite nations, heim omrim lohem, kol aretz shelak kodesh baruch hu hi. Everything of the all of the world, everything in the world, all the land belongs to God. Hu bara the nas lasher Yosha Beinov. He created. He gave it to who he wanted. Birtzona nas nolahem. Birtzona not lamehem. Vnas nolanu. If he wanted it, he started off giving it to them, and he took it from them, and he gave it to us. Now, for me, this Rashi is incredible because, you know, I'm trying to imagine the scene in the UN. You know, where the representative of Israel stands up and whips out this Rashi, you know, and says to everybody, the reason why we have the first of the Pentateuch is because of this. I don't think it'll go down so well. For some reason, you know, we've the archaeology isn't working. So what's Rashi saying? And I, just after thinking about it very, very carefully and clearly, look at the pasuk that Rashi quotes. Look what Rashi says. Well, what's the pasuk in Tehillim? Koyach Masov, the strength of his actions, he gives La'amo, he told his nation. Meaning to say, who's the prime recipient, who's the prime beneficiary of this first section of the Torah and understanding history is? Us. We need to appreciate it. First and foremost, before the conversation happens with anybody else, we need to appreciate the foundational history of what this place means. That's what we're about to learn. More than that, I wonder, if you want to dig it just a little bit deeper, I wonder. The notion of what Rashi is saying is that Hashem created the world, and therefore he has the right to give and retract the place of the holy places in the world. Look at the last 2,000 years. Just think about this for a moment. Meaning to say, Hashem took it away from the Ummah Sa'olam, but he warned us at the end of Parshas Achrei Mosen Kadoshim that if we don't behave well, what's going to happen? He'll take it from us as well. Okay, so just appreciate that. What Rashi is saying over here is also deeper, is that Rashi is saying is, don't take it for granted. Meaning to say, you need to understand and appreciate it to get it. It doesn't necessarily mean it's always yours. It may be taken away, and it has been taken away. We're going to see empire after empire after empire took it away from each other after us until finally we were gifted it again. This is the starting point. And as opposed to trying to work archaeologically and work backwards, that's almost the reverse way of approaching it. Let's work forwards. Let's start at the very beginning. The very, very beginning and work all the way onwards. Now, a number of these sources you may know, a number of these sources I guarantee you probably have not seen. Very, very fascinating. We're working through today the biblical history. Next week, what we're going to do is we're going to work post-biblical, and we're going to do it from the perspective of travelers and people who've been there all the way through the last 2,000 years. Let's start at the very beginning. The Mishnah in Masech Zuma tells us the following. Mishnah Nitel Aaron, when there was no longer an Aaron, there was no Aaron in the second temple, Evan Haisa Shami Mois Nevi'im Rishonim V'Shesia Haisa Nikreis. There was a stone there, and it was called Shesia. It was above the ground. It jutted out 3 fingers high, and this is referring to the service of the Kohen Gadol in the absence of the Aaron. Okay, this is where he had sprinkled. This is where he put the Ketores. Okay, what does it mean? What does it mean? Evan Shasia, right? It's almost the nursing stone. But what does this mean? Says the Gemara on that Mishnah in the Gemara in Yuma. Because from it, from that rock, the world is nursed. That means to say that the center of place, you know, that all reality can be Kabbalistically divided up into 3 parameters. The parameter of place, time, and soul. Ashan. Those are the three parameters. It's interesting that when Einstein started talking about time, space, continuity, he was right, that's in that direction on the physics side is sort of approximating back to the metaphysics. Now, interestingly enough, this is what the Gemara is saying is ultimately that space is generated from this place, right? The Evan Shasia is the portal of all space to be expanded from there. Very fascinating concept. The Gemara goes on to have a number of deos of what happens. Tanan, Commander Omar, Mitzion Nivra Olam. And this is according to the Manda Amar, who says that Mitzion from Mount Zion was the west of the world was generated. And there's a number of different opinions of how and why throughout the rest of the Gemara. So you want to start at the very beginning, before you get anywhere else, is that the Temple Mount's significance is because it actually is the center of place. And by the way, that's why it's interesting that Aliyah Regel is the combination of all those 3 parameters. Regel is that space and time. Is that moment in time, the moment in place, converged by the neshamas of Israel, all converging at the same time, if you think about that, to the Temple Mount. Halachic application, just fascinating. I don't know if anybody realizes this. Rabbi Chil Michal Tukachunsky wrote a number of svarim. One of them is called Ir HaKodesh VaMikdash, and he wrote another one about the dateline. And here's how the two converge. He says the following: Umikavan in Psalm 7, Shekadur al pi hekef yor hayomi mischalek lishnei tzadim mizrach umarov. He has to deal with the question of creating a dateline, because remember, until we had fast travel, train travel, we never really needed to consider the dateline because time was relative. You'd set it based on the noon of each place. But when you started moving very fast from one city to another, you needed to have a standard time, because otherwise, how do the schedules work? That's when they started dividing up the world into different time zones, and they had to have a place where time started and ended each day. So there was the international dateline, which is 180 degrees from the Greenwich Meridian, because that's where That's where, at the time, the center of this science was, says Rav Yechiel Mekotunsky, Behechresh shemaskel yom inkros Yerushalayim, v'nimshach lamarav chatzi kadur, l'mizrach chatzi kadur, kuf peiz malos lakan, v'kuf peiz malos lakan, l'fichach amru, b'supereinu hayomam, shekava tarech at Yisrael, v'kuf peiz malos Yerushalayim. He says, where is the international deadline in Halacha? It must be if time and space is generated from Jerusalem, from the Temple Mount, it must be 180 degrees in either direction. That fascinating? His halachic dateline is 180 degrees in either side, on either way, from Jerusalem. Is Jerusalem mean time? That's how it works. Not Greenwich. Greenwich is arbitrary. So, this is actually an interesting application. He's commenting on this Gemara in Yuma. He also goes on to talk about the Moilad being, of course, over the mountains of Yerushalayim on a similar basis. Let's go further. We're only at the beginning of creation. What about day six? Day six says the Zohar in Bereishis. Humanity, in fact, was also pulled out of the place of the Mikdash. The Midrash Rabbah explains, what does that mean? It wasn't from the place of the Aaron, but it was from the place of his atonement. What's that place? Says the Gemara, Heich lemad da'at Omar, Mizbech adamot ha'aseli. What does it mean that there's an altar of earth? Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hare ani bore oisoi mimokom kaparosoi, v'alevai ya'amod, v'yiftach ba'apoi, v'yipach ba'apoi, melamed she'emidoi goyla min ha'oretz v'adak erakiyach, and that goes on the rest of the discussion. Mean to say, where was the earth, the clod of earth, of humanity pulled from? From the place of the Mizbech. That's why it's called Mizbeach Adama, because Mizbeach Adama is the Adama of humanity, which is interesting. So I mean to say, just a little further in the same compound is that place, and this also relates to the Shisim. The Shisim are these pipes which go underneath the Mizbeach. The Gemara in Sukkah talks about the significance of that when it comes to the wine and water libations, coming from this particular issue. So we move from day one of creation to essentially the sixth day of creation. Let's take it a little further. Very, very fascinating. By Noach. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer tells us, actually this is in the very bottom of the page, in source 10, the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, one of the oldest Midrashim extant, says, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Be'etzpa hera HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Avram Vinu HaMizbeach, V'Omer Lo Yizehu HaMizbeach. Hashem showed Abraham the altar and said, this is it. Ruoyo HaMizbeach She'ekrivu Kain V'Hevel. It was the same altar that Kain V'Hevel actually sacrificed on. V'hu HaMizbeach She'ekrivu Noach U'Bonov. Shenem avayiven sham Avraham mizbeach, enksiv kan elo avayiven sham Avraham mizbeach, hu hamizbeach shekrivu bo harishonim. It's not just any mizbeach, it was the altar of Avraham, the altar of Kain and Hevel, the altar of Noach going back. Problem is, you look in the Pesukim, it doesn't seem to be that's what's going on. Pesukim say in Bereishis, Yud Aleph, he walks out of the Teva, this is in Perek Ches, vayiven on Noach mizbeach la'ashem, vayikach mikol behema atoirah mikoloi fatahor, vayal oles abba mizbeach. It sounds like he built the altar. Right? Sounds like he built the altar. Doesn't sound like he was sacrificing on the altar of Kain Vehevel. And the obvious answer is, why did he need to build the Mizbeach? Because everything was destroyed. Right? So that's what the Targum Yonasan says. Ubonu Noach midbucho akodem Hashem, hu madbucho debono odom biidon deitrad min ganosa de Eden. He rebuilt the altar of Adam. Right? Why didn't he rebuild it? Because this is interesting. Because technically speaking, Noach actually landed on Ararat. We're talking in Turkey, right? But it must have been, according to this Midrash, that he traveled. Where was the place that he actually was able? He understood was the place to reconnect with God was in that same place. Isn't it interesting? Some of them unfortunately actually talk about how the Mabul was a recreation of the world. It wasn't, right? The Mabul was actually a time where everything was obliterated, the Mayanos Tohom and the Arubas HaShomayim, heaven and sea closed, like day two. It was a recreation. At that recreation point, we reaccess the same place. Isn't that fascinating? Let's take a little further. The next place we have it more explicitly is by Avram. Yesterday's Parsha's Lech Lecha, Umalki Tzelek Melech Sholem, Hoitzi Lechem V'Yayim V'Hu Kain Le'El Yon. So we have Melchi Tzedek, who is the king of Sholem, bringing out these libations to Avram upon the conclusion of the battle of the four and five kings. Okay? Sounds similar, but how do we know? Meaning, how do we know that Sholem is Yerushalayim? Very simple. Pasukim Tehillim. The Pasukim Tehillim says, Vahi b'Sholem sukoi umonosa b'Sion. Where was the sukkah? Where was the residing place of God? In Sholem. Meaning to say, Sholem means Yerushalayim. You know what the problem is? That's only half the word. Where does the other half of the word come from? This week's parasha. this explosion in Parshas Vayera, this is why it's so timely. Right? The Palestinians couldn't have got a better timing. This week's parasha is, of course, the Akedah. We're told the following. Avram Avinu is sent, Vayiach Advarim O'ele, Vayakim Nisoyas Avram, Vayomer Hashem Elov, Avram Vayomer Neni. And he sends to him, go to Eretz HaMoriah, the land of Moriah. And at the end of this whole, the whole test and Avram's success, at the very end in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Perek Chof Beis, he says, Vayis Avram Esenov, Vayari Neva Ayel Achar Niachaz Bislach Bakarnov. So he sees this ram skipping to the next pasuk. Vayikra Avraham Shem Amakom Ahu Hashem Yireh. That place is called Hashem Yireh. Asher Yomer Hayom Bahar Hashem Yeroeh. On the hand, the place where Hashem will appear will be appeared in front of, and that's what Avraham calls it. And of course, it's noteworthy that Yerushalayim is a composition of both the word Yirah and Shalem, right? Meaning Yerushalayim is the combination of Yirah and Shalem. These two parashiyos together. How do we know that Har Moriah is Jerusalem? Right, so actually we know about it because when Shlomo Melech builds his Beis HaMikdash, as it says in Devarei Yamim, the pasuk says, Vayochel Shlomo livnos es Beis Hashem b'Yerushalayim b'Har HaMoriah. This, you know, just to have whole cold facts. Devarei Yamim was written long before Islam was invented. Just so we should all have that on the table. Okay? We're talking about over here, Har HaMoriah is clearly identified with Yerushalayim, where the temple was built. And therefore, going back, this is the place where Avram had the Akedah. This is the place that Melchizedek arrived from. Yerushalayim is the composition of both names. We're going to study in just a moment why it is that the Torah seems to not explicitly identify Yerushalayim until much later, until after the Torah is concluded. We're going to get to that in just a moment. So the first place after we reach the Torah itself is the following. Yehoshua enters the land. He brings in the forces of Israel. And He makes a number of conquests, but what happens is a number of coalitions are formed. Canaanite coalitions are formed against Yehoshua. And we're told the following. Vayikishmo Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim. Apparently Adoni is the name of the king of this particular area. Adoni Tzedek is now the king of Shalem, not Malki. Okay, and so Adoni Tzedek is the king of Yerushalayim. Ki lokad Yehoshua esalai vayachrimo kasher asali richo lemalko. Ken asalai lemalko. He hears about the conquests of Ha'ai and Jericho. And then also about the peace made with the nation of Givon. Givon's made peace, and Givon's a very big bastion. So he says, "Vayishlach Adoni Tzedek Melech Yerushalayim El Hoyham Melech Chevron Vel Pirom Melech Yarmus Vel Yafia Melech Ilachish Vel Zvir Melech Eglon Neymar Alu Alai VeIzru Izruni VeNakeis Givon." So what they do is they form a coalition, these five kings, to conquer Givon, because Givon's been, they want to punish the peacemakers. So that's what they do, and then Israel comes to their aid, and there's an incredible battle, and they beat them, and this is where the stones fall from heavens. This is a very miraculous battle which ensues. At this point you'd think, well, if Adoni Tzedek, who's the king of Yerushalayim, has been conquered, therefore, whose hands should Jerusalem be in at this point in time? Should be Jewish, but it isn't. Interestingly enough, we're told in the division of the land in Yehoshua later on in Perek Tesvav, so although Yehuda was given that area, they weren't able to conquer the Jebusites who remained in that stronghold. And they stayed until that day. Later on in Shoftim, the first parak of Shoftim, we're told that Binyamin attacks from the other side. Right? I mean, Binyamin's territory is just north of Yehuda, also overlapping on Yerushalayim. As we know, Yerushalayim is actually between Binyamin and Yehuda. And again, in Shoftim, it tells us that the Bnei Binyamin were not able to conquer the area of Yavus because they were very strong. Apparently, these Yavusi had some sort of secret weapon. We meet that secret weapon a little later on in Tanakh. Because although it remains a stronghold for all the time of Shoftim and Yehoshua, which is a period of almost 400 years, so you should realize when we were first in the land of Israel, we didn't have access. We didn't actually know where it was yet, interestingly enough. Nonetheless, the first move made by David HaMelech when he became king over all Israel is the following. It's interesting. It is literally, you could see David was waiting for this his whole life. Because immediately as he becomes king, this is what he does. Remember that David HaMelech is being chased, he's being pursued by Shaul all of his life. When Shaul dies, he is made king of the southern kingdom in Hebron over Yehuda. And when when Ishbosheth is no longer there, then what happens David is now made king. There's a whole problem that goes on with Avner and Yoav. Be it as it may, when he finally becomes king, this is what happens. First thing that happens, Oh, actually, before even we get there, I apologize. We skipped out one very important part. And that is when David is being pursued, David, when he first realizes that Shaul really wants to kill him, Shaul sends Malachim to get him. And in Shmuel Aleph Yuteschov Bez in source 20, Vayelech Gamhu Haramasa Vayvoad Bor HaGadol Asher Beshechu, Sechu Vayishal Vayomer Eifo Shmuel V'David Vayomer Hinei B'Nayot B'Ramah. That Shaul is searching for David, and he's told that David has now visited Shmuel Hanavi in Nayot in Ramah. Now, that sounds like there's two places, right? There's Nayot and there's Ramah. So which place is he in? And all the Mephoshim try to work out, maybe Nayot is a subsection, maybe it's a different name for it. So, nonetheless, the Radak quotes Chazal saying, Rabbi Hussein Uzal Amru, Ma'inyan Nayos Eisel Ramah, Ela Shayo Yoshvim Baramah, Voiskim Benayosh El Olam, Kleimar Beves Amigdash, Kleimar Beves Amakom Yiyye. David HaMelech, when he was being pursued by Shaul HaMelech, realized that he needed to find Shmuel for advice. What was the one piece of advice that Shmuel gave David before Shmuel dies himself was? The piece of advice was where to build the Beves Amigdash. You can imagine now how the treason of David has now, in Shaul's eyes, has now reached its maximum. From now onwards, there's no reprieve. Because Shaul realizes that when Shmuel gives David that key, he's giving David that key and not himself, because the true king is going to be the one to build the Beis HaMikdash. That's what happens. So David HaMelech is now living with this blueprint in his mind. He wants to get to this place. He doesn't have access to it. Immediately after he has access, he becomes king. In source 22, Shmuel Beis, Perek Hei. Vayvo kol shifti Yisrael David Chevron vayomer leimor, hinanu atzmecho b'sorcho anachnu. Now that David suddenly comes to power, everybody's like, "Oh, we're all your friend. We're all you're our brother," and they make gam esmol gam shilsham b'yoshol melech olenu. Even yes, you know, it looked like we had allegiance to Shaul HaMelech right in those days. However, atah yisom ha'moitziyam avamiyas mevias Yisrael. We knew you were really the leader. Vayomer Hashem lecha atah tire es ami es Yisrael atah tiel nagid al Yisrael. We know that Hashem says that you should be the leader. Fine, and they take him and they make a bris in Hebron and they make him the king of all Israel. Perek Hay Pasuk Dalet. First thing he does. Ben Shloshim Shana David b'Malkai Aboim Shana Malach b'Hebron Malach al Yehuda Sheva Shanim v'Shisha Chadashim v'Yerushalayim Malach Shloshim v'Shalosh Shana al Kol Yisrael v'Yehuda. We are given his whole career is 7 years in Hebron and 33 years in Yerushalayim. Then he says, "Vayelech haMelech vaAnoshav Yerushalayim Ela Yevusiyah Yosheva Oretz." He went to that one place which was inconquerable, to the Jebusites. "Vayomer David Leimor Lo Yisavo Heino Ki Misircha Es HaIvrim VaAsapischim Leimor Lo Yavoi David Heino." And he said, "We can't conquer Yerushalayim unless we remove these Ivrim and Pischim." David HaMelech is somehow being prevented by these Ivrim and Pischim. Very hard to know what they are. The Mephoshim struggle. The Radak tenders a number of possibilities. One of the possibilities he suggests, the most basic possibility that the Mephoshim suggest, is that they have these mechanical gods, that they have these water-powered gods which wave sticks and swords and spears up and down, and because it's a water system, it's very hard to get in. There's always movement. He can't penetrate the city. And so the whole story is how Yoav gets up behind and is able to conquer and enter Jerusalem. But if you go a little deeper, what happens is the Radak says that no, in fact, over here, there was actually a theological question which was preventing them entering. And that is that we know that in this week's parasha, Avimelech sees that Avram is doing well, and he says, "Elakim imcha b'chol asher atah aseh, God is with you, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a covenant with you. That we're not going to harm each other. We're not going to harm each other. Im lenechti, for my children, grandchildren, there's not going to be any interface between the two nations." Happens to be the Yevusi, according to the Radak, is a descendant of not the seven nations of Israel, but Philistine origin. So what they were saying was, they were putting up a covenant which was supposed to be adhered to by Yaakov and Yitzchak, the children and grandchildren of Avram Avinu. And we know that Yitzchak was blind and Yaakov Avinu was maimed. So they put up these images as a reminder of the covenant of the Philistines with Israel. And what was preventing them was that international treaty. That was what was going on. David HaMelech said, of course, there's a statute of limitation. Right? It was l'niniyu l'nechti. It was only two generational. You don't have that immunity anymore, as David was able to do. There's a fascinating Ralbag. There's a fascinating Ralbag. When you see this Ralbag, if I'm understanding this correctly, this is shocking. Source 24, the Ralbag says, on this, what was preventing David from conquering Jerusalem? He says... He says the following. He says, "Vayilko David mayavusi es metzuras tzion hi ir David bayom v'omar David bayom bayom ha'u kimi shiyake yavusi v'yiga betzinor hu ha'merzev shnishpachim imenu ha'mayim." So David Melech made a proclamation: whoever hits the yavusi and destroys the pipe system, with this water system that they had protecting the city, v'yashis am hashchasasoya satzinor apischim v'ayvirim shem soyne devesh David mitzad shiyamnuuhu milavoy al abayis. He puts out a ward on whoever does this. Maybe it was really an iver or pesach which was preventing David from entering the house. Which, if you take this on a face value, it sounds like what they were doing was they were putting their ivrim and pischim, their maimed and blind people, on the battlefront. Is that unbelievable? If this is what the rabbi is saying, that means to say that what was preventing David from access was the human shield. Isn't that crazy? They were putting out, and you just hear history reverberating once again. This is the first conquest of Yerushalayim. David HaMelech conquers Yerushalayim. The first thing he does in Perek Vav. This is Perek Hay in Shmuel Beis. Next thing he does, he says, "Let's bring you the Aaron to Jerusalem." The Aaron is in exile. The Mishkan is destroyed. They take the Aaron and David HaMelech wants to bring it up. They bring it up on a cart. It doesn't work. It slips off the cart. They should have carried it. Uzzah stretches out his hand, dies. David HaMelech tries again. And in this time, he brings it and it's carried up and they dance in front of it. This is the time when Michal criticizes David HaMelech for dancing in front of the Aaron. Machar kebe kol oz. As he's dancing. Why is he dancing? Because it's the first time the Aaron can find its place. David knows something about this place, about Jerusalem. He comes up to Jerusalem. As in Perek Zion, immediately after the Aaron's returned to the area of Jerusalem, there's different stages of who it's in the house of Obed Edom, because he's scared that the Aaron could hurt people. He doesn't want to bring it into the city itself. David HaMelech says, David HaMelech turns to Nathan HaNavi, because Shmuel is no longer around, and he says in, this is source 26, Shmuel Beis, he says in Perek Zion, Pasuk Gimel, Zayin Beis, Vayomer Melech El Nasa Navi Re'ei, Anachi Re'eina, Anachi Yoshev Bevesa Razim, Vayron Elekim Yoshev Bevesochar Yiriyah. I'm sitting in a well-fortified and comfortable house, and the Aaron is sitting in a tent. What's going on? So what David HaMelech is saying, what does he want? Think about David's career. He becomes a king, he conquers Yavus, he brings the Aaron back, and the next thing he says is, "Let's build a Beis Hamikdash." You see the perspective of what David HaMelech is trying to achieve. Hashem comes to Nathan in a dream and says, "It's not going to happen." Doesn't explain why. He says, "Don't worry, I'm going to give you longevity. I'm going to give you a continuation with your children. Your child's going to build the Beis Hamikdash." Doesn't explain why. If you go to Divrei Hayamim, in the recounting of the same thing, then in Divrei Hayamim it adds in an extra detail. And that is, "Ki yadecha damim maleu," that your hands are full of blood. The Mefarshim struggle. What does that mean, your hands are full of blood? Sounds interesting. Sounds interesting as to what's going on over here. There's a number of suggestions which are tendered as to what's the problem, what's holding up David from making the Beis Hamikdash right now. One of them is simply that David's tafkid was conquest of the land. And the necessary cruelty or the necessary proactiveness of conquest prevents a person from creating a place of peace. Could also mean it's the blood of Uriah. Could also mean the blood of Uriah, the guilt that David had for the wife, the husband of Bathsheba. The Mefarshim go through this at length as to what's really going on over here. I just wonder historically, it's interesting to see that historically speaking, we're living in a time where we're in the place of conquest. We're in the time where we're regaining our space. And we're regaining our holy places in Israel. We should remember it's sequential. We should remember that there's a stage of conquest, as David HaMelech had, to regain security, and then there's the next stage of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. In terms of model, in terms of thinking about this. Let's go a little further. David HaMelech is denied that access. Nonetheless, his son, Shlomo HaMelech, as we know, at the end of David HaMelech's life, this is really one of the last things that David HaMelech achieves, is that there's a plague going on. He counts the people, there's a plague, people are dying, this is the very end of Shmuel Beis, and David HaMelech, in the middle of this, this is where Atachanun comes from, by the way, in Source 27, Shmuel Beis, Chav Dal Yud Zayin. Vayomer David al Hashem, Viroisa, Samala, Hamake, Baom. Vayomer Inachi, Anachi, Tasi, Vanachi, Havisi, Ver al Seme, Osu, Tehino, Yod Chabi, Ube'e, Savi. Don't kill them, kill me. This is where David's suffering because of the people suffering on his behalf. What does he do? What's the anecdote to the plague in Pasuk Yudches? Vayova God el David vayomahu vayomer alei hakeim Hashem laHashem izbeach begoren arvon aravno hayavusi. Go make an altar in the threshing hall in the granary of Arvona, and it goes on to tell us in the Pesukim explicitly that David HaMelech went to Arvona and he was offered the field, and David HaMelech says, nonetheless, I want to buy it. Sounds very similar to Avram and Ephron. Interestingly enough, what's going on over here? The Radak points out over here. He says that the Radak asks the obvious question. Wait a second, didn't David conquer this territory, right? Meaning, wasn't this military conquest? Why is he going to Arvona now and he's buying the land? He should simply walk in and say, don't you remember me? I have the right to this land. I killed you all. So Radak says, Aravna Amelech, Melech Hayavusi Hayoshev Yerushalayim Haya, Ki Af Bimei David Haya Hayavusi Yerushalayim, Kumoish Nisharu Sham Mishe Kavshua Bnei Yehuda, Kumoish Kosa Vayesha Hayavusi Es Bnei Yehuda Yerushalayim Ara Yom Azeh. So he said, even though they were conquered, and they were conquered a little earlier, even in the times of Yerushua, says the Radak, nonetheless, a number of the Yevusi were allowed to remain. They were tax-paying servants. Their proceeds from their fields and their granaries would go to Israel. And he wanted to just give it as a gift to David. Nonetheless, and David would nonetheless not receive it except with money. It's ironic. It's David HaMelech is going. David HaMelech is going to every nth degree to prove to himself and the world and history that the place was not stolen. Meaning he conquered the land, but nonetheless he still bought it, like Avraham Avinu and Hebron. And isn't it interesting that the most contentious places in Israel today are, we're talking about Hebron, we're talking about the Harabais. Nonetheless, this is how Sefer Shmuel ends. The plague stops when David buys this place. What happens over here is that it closes with David's closest proximity to being able to get Harabais, and that is the buying of the place of Harabais. Shlomo HaMelech takes the mission forward. Shlomo HaMelech says, this is the famous pasuk which dates everything in Melachim Aleph Chof Perek Vav. Vayibi shmonim shana va'aba me'al shana latzeis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim b'shana revi'is b'chodesh ziv hu chodesh sheni limloch Shlomo al Yisrael vayiven ba'is la'Hashem. He builds the house to Hashem. At the end of this building is a long chapter. Perek Zion is a very, very long chapter telling all the details of the ba'is of Shlomo. Just you notice the diagram on the right. Right, which is one of the illustrations of this temple. It looks very different to the pictures of the temple that we see usually, because the pictures we see of the temple are usually the pictures of the temple of Herod. This really is essentially the third temple. We're going to get there in a moment, because in Bais Sheni had two temples. This one, if you notice, there's two pillars on the right and the left, the Yochin and Boaz. They were named on either side of the Mizbeach. There's the Yamshel Shlomo, is that round basin supported by the bronze cows just behind the Mizbeach. It's very different to the structure that we look at and hear about when we talk about the picture of Herod's building. We're going to get to Herod, God willing, next week. At the end of this, we don't have an incredible amount of time, so I just want to make a few comments. At the end of this, it talks about how Shlomo gathers all the people and this incredible celebration that Shlomo has and the blessing he gave to the people. After this, in Perek Ches, really the second half of the chapter is dedicated to a prayer that Shlomo HaMelech makes at the dedication of the temple. And to me, it's so fascinating. A lot of it is talking about listen to our prayers, give us protection, give us health, give us all these beautiful things that Shlomo HaMelech says. And in and amongst that, embedded in that, is the following, and this is something which we should really consider today. In Perek Ches Pasuk Mem Aleph, after everything about the Jews, V'gam es el hanochri asher loy me'amcha Yisrael hu, uvo me'eretz rechaka l'man shmecha. And to those non-Jews, to those strangers who come from the far land, to the land of Israel, for your name, ki yishmu'un es shimcha agadol ves yodcha chazaka, because they hear your great name and your strong hand, uzaracha n'tuyah, uvoli spalel el abayis hazeh, and they come to pray in this house. Is that prophetic? Just think about what Shlomo is saying. The nations of the world will come to your, they'll hear your name and they'll come to pray in your house. Listen to them from your house and do. Listen to them from this place so they should know your name. To know that your name is on this house. Isn't it fascinating that the three monotheistic religions, which encompass more than half of the world's populations today, all declare the same site their holy site? Isn't that unbelievable? And by the way, in Judaism over here, we don't kill people who try to come visit as well. There's a place, now there's limitations, is where the Nochri can walk, but there's a place for the prayers. Ki vesi ves tefillah, l'chol ha'amim. Right, when at the moment of creation, it's a place for the Jews, but it's also a place for the rest of the world to be there too. Isn't that unbelievable? This is the Muslims haven't caught up to this yet. The Malbim, in fact, adds to this that in fact Hashem is even more liberal with their prayers. That for us, we need to have a condition. We need to act up. We need to live up to a certain standard to be able to be answered. Whereas the non-Jews will even in this place will even receive perhaps even for bad intentions. Will receive the answer to their prayers. Fascinating comment the Malbim has over here. We're at the point where we're a little bit out of time. What I wanted to cover a little more as well was the splitting of the kingdom, the destruction of the temple, and the rebuilding of the second base of Midrash, which is all in Tanakh. But we're a little strapped for time at this point in time. I don't want to rush this. What I would like to do is to leave that. I'm going to put this into the second segment as we move on post to the second temple, post Tanakh. We get into the Maccabees, into Herod, into Agrippa, and then Titus, and then and Hadrian, and the very, very fast changes which occur in the first millennia in terms of the hand changing of the Temple Mount and the Crusades thereafter. We're going to go into the next week. I'd like to just leave you with a question which relates to this section, and that is that it is very ironic that if this is the place which is so holy to us and a number of our enemies will claim this against us, why is it that whenever the Torah tells us to go to the Yerushalayim to find the Beis HaMikdash, it's always about L'shichna Sidrashu Vasa Shama. You should go to the there. The Torah never explicates where that there is. The Torah always talks about there being a place, but it never tells us where the place is. Why would it be that the Torah should specifically, until later on, actually even to the times of David HaMelech, not tell us where it is? There's very profound reasons in Jewish philosophy as to why that is. But we need to think, and I'm going to leave it with the question before we start part two, is why is it that it's left as a mystery, as a discovery?